Michael is a person of a great knowledge and enormous wit. And it's just so wonderful to have him here. I wanted to tell you that Fragments in Time and Space draws primarily on the Hirschhorn collection. So the works here are all in the collection of the Hirschhorn Museum, and these works demonstrate the diverse ways in which time and space have been conceptualized, employed, and manipulated. Now, a short introduction to Michael. Michael is the J.R. Herbert Boone Chair in the Humanities at the Johns Hopkins University. He teaches in the Department of History of Art and focuses on modern art, literature, critical theory, and modern poetry. He is also a poet, in addition to being art historian and critic, and has written extensively on abstract painting and sculpture since World War II, to art criticism from mid-18th century France to contemporary photography. Along with Clement Greenberg, T.J. Clark, and Rosalind Krauss, he is well known for his contribution to the debates over the origins and development of modernism, including the 1967 essay Art and Objecthood. In one of his most recent books, Why Photography Matters as Never Before, Michael discusses works by artists like Jeff Wall, Douglas Gordon, who is actually included, both of them are included in this presentation, Hiroshi Sugimoto, who also is included here. As he told me this evening, his most recent book is Four Honest Outlaws, Sala, Ray, Marione, and Gordon. Michael has a very fantastic sense of art, is amazingly passionate, and I cannot wait to have him walk us through the exhibition. Welcome, Michael.
Okay. Thank you, Milena. So what I'm going to do is walk us through this exhibition sort of from beginning to end, one room after another. Milena's already given you some sense of what the sort of intellectual parameters of the exhibition are. This examination of the way in which art, the earliest work we're looking at here are some photographs by Thomas Aikens from the 1880s, have worked with notions of space and time. Time in particular, but the translation between the two. I'm going to be less interested tonight in saying a lot about how that exactly works. I'm an art historian, but I'm also an art critic. So what I'm going to be saying is also judgmental. I'm going to be talking about which works here mean the most to me, seem to me the best. There'll be others that I'm less crazy about. So one of the things that you'll know by the end of this walk is which ones I like and which ones I don't. And I'll try to sort of make that coherent. I'm also perfectly willing at some point, if somebody has a question that feels of absolute burning urgency, by just, you know, raise your hand and we can get the question. So let's start. We'll go into this room. And there are three artists. Let me also say, once people are in here, this is an exhibition put together by the top curator at the Hirschhorn, a man named Kerry Brower, who is a superb curator, who's been responsible for a succession of magnificent exhibitions of contemporary art over the last 20 or 25 years, not just here, but in Los Angeles, where he was before at LA MoCA. I was lucky enough to meet Kerry in Los Angeles a long time ago. And I remember then he went and became the head of the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford, England, which feels like an oxymoron and probably is. And then he came to the Hirschhorn. And I remember sitting in Baltimore one day and reading the New York Times and seeing that Kerry Brower was coming to the Hirschhorn and sort of yelling out a kind of cry of happiness because he was going to be here. And he's just done a wonderful job. And this exhibition, which I think is brilliantly installed, is very much Kerry's handiwork and has his personal stamp. So we're in a room with three artists. There's one work on the wall back there, if we can somehow see it. This is an artist named An Kawara, O-N. Kawara. And Ankawara has, since the 70s and even before, been making paintings more or less exactly like that one. They are, by and large, pretty small paintings. They're monochrome. Technically, they're monochromes. That is to say, they consist of a single field of color. And then on the monochrome, he puts the date of the day on which he made the painting. And so that's part of a project, and this is where it fits into an exhibition like this with respect to issues of time. It's a question of how one is going to understand that project. The most interesting and really quite brilliant essay on Kawara's work that you can find is by the photographer Jeff Wall, we'll be seeing a terrific photograph by Jeff Wall towards the end of this show. But Wall also happens to be an utterly brilliant writer about photography, and not just about photography. And he would see Kawara's enterprise in general as being a kind of combining of the monochrome, which is a certain sort of extreme gesture in modern painting, the work of a single color, right? Together with a certain intellectual component, the dates having to be serving as almost some kind of vestige of the impulse of history painting, an earlier traditional kind of painting, marking some kind of historical event. I find Kawara's work interesting, especially having read Jeff, but I never find the works compelling as artifacts. I mean, this is one of the things that you just have to decide for yourself when you're dealing with contemporary art. For a considerable period of time now, and this is partly the work of a movement within contemporary art, which we could loosely call conceptualism, where we have artists who are pursuing projects that are serious projects, intellectually respectable projects like Kawara, but the question is, when it's all said and done, are you left with a painting or an artifact, a sculpture, whatever, that can really hold your attention? Do you want to stand in front of October 24th, 1971, for 45 minutes, exploring its depths? I think the answer is no. Kawara himself would not claim that you should. I mean, it's a certain form of gesture. I am not actually, in what I'm saying now, I don't wish to be understood, I'm not demeaning it. I would take it seriously in a certain way, but I am hopelessly committed to, in some ways, the old-fashioned, but it also turns out it hasn't gone away. It's even been born again. Point of view where what I want out of art is something that I want to look at, that I can barely tear myself away from, that I am gripped by, that I am moved by. And I suppose what I want to say, if there's any little moral to what I'm saying tonight, is don't give up on that point of view too quickly. Don't let somebody persuade you that art has moved so drastically and radically away from that possibility that it's simply old-fashioned to think that way. It turns out, and you will see works, we'll see works tonight, recent works where they are completely gripping to look at. And that would be, for me, the highest value. We also have a painting here in a strange sort of almost trompe-l'oeil semi-realistic style by a Los Angeles painter, photographer, artist named Ed Ruscha, R-U-S-C-H-A. A very interesting figure, someone who emerged in the California scene. California and Los Angeles in particular became a kind of alternate venue to New York back in the 60s and 70s. It never quite eclipsed New York at that time. But of all the artists working in Los Angeles at that moment, the one who's had the greatest, almost like subsequent career, and those works now seem more and more fascinating to more and more people, would be Ruscha. And this is a work which, again, fits into this exhibition in all sorts of obvious ways. We seem to have this strange, feels like a kind of bare bones fishing rod against this large clock or watch face. And it's executed in a manner which would link it, let's say, with developments in pop art, but also in photorealism as they were going to happen. Again, I leave it to you to decide how you feel about it. We're going to see something else of Rouchet's over there. For me, let's say the most compelling works in this particular space are the photographs on that wall. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Photographs by a Japanese photographer who sort of splits his time between Tokyo and America and other places. Extremely admired and successful figure today named Hiroshi Sugimoto, S-U-G-I-M-O-T-O. Sugimoto is a very brilliant and creative and constantly sort of self-transforming artist. I first heard about Sugimoto. I came to photography late. I had to do a lot of catch-up in order to sort of get with it. And someone who was enormously helpful to me in that sort of project was Kerry Brower. Brower had already worked with Sugimoto, exhibited Sugimoto, and he introduced me to Sugimoto's work. So it's fitting that I should be talking about Sugimoto in an exhibition put together by Kerry. These are a series of works by Sugimoto. Really, they are among the early works that made him very well known, of movie theaters. Basically, movie theaters in America, in different cities in America. And what Sugimoto did was go into the movie theater, set up a camera. You can see it at some elevated height, presumably in the balcony, and open the lens of the camera for the entire duration of a film. So what you're seeing now is a photograph where the negative was exposed for the entire duration of a film. Because the film was running on the screens are lit, right? And you can't pick up any further detail because it was just moving through the entire film. And everything else in the dark is registered in contrast to that bright screen. The photographs themselves are then rather beautifully printed at this, in a sense, modest scale. Now, these are works that absolutely invite very close scrutiny. If you have the chance, these are photos to go up, look closely at. You can kind of explore the space. Sometimes, in some of them, you can almost pick up ghostly images of people who are in the audience. I don't think I saw that in any of these photographs. They're also, in a way, they bear witness to a kind of disappearing artifact, the sort of grand, old-fashioned American movie theater. But there's something else that goes on here. When I started to get involved with recent art photography, by which I really mean a kind of movement in art photography that starts pretty much in the late 1970s, though it has a prehistory as well, photography has been an enormously significant and innovative art. From the late 1970s, let's call it 1980 to now, over those 30 years, 30 plus years. In some ways, it has been the flagship visual art, more than either painting or sculpture, although there have been significant painters and sculptors during that period. And when I started to, as I say, belatedly become aware of that, and started to try to learn how to look at photographs, one of the things that one becomes aware of that maybe one isn't aware, I mean, I wasn't aware of, is how much time and duration get inscribed inside of photographs. I mean, what we think of photographs as being fundamentally instantaneous, because let's say if we're taking photographs, by and large, that's what we want. We want a photograph that's going to be instantaneous, that's going to capture somebody if they're moving, that isn't going to be all blurred, and so on and so forth. These things have been, the shutter's been open for 90 minutes, let's say, maybe longer. And in general, in the art photographs that we're going to be looking at, the issue of duration in the making of the photograph becomes very, very important. It's one of the things that is going to be, there are many significant differences between what a photograph shows us of the world and what we see when we look at the world. Again, photographs have functioned for us, by and large, as something like equivalents of ordinary vision. A photograph tells the truth. But even if you just take a single thing, like the photograph basically having one lens and we all have two eyes, that's already a drastic difference between what you see in a photograph and what we see with a kind of lived experience of looking. But this issue of duration is really important. And here, you see that it's built into the very idea of the photographs, right? That we're getting something that we can see all at once, that's open to us all at once, but which also invites us to think of it in terms of duration being built into it, right? And the drastically different lighting and so on and so forth. So these are extremely interesting, conceptually brilliant, but also, I think, very beautiful photographs. Another issue that's going to arise in photography through this whole period is the issue of scale. One of the things that starts to happen in ambitious art photography in the late 1970s is photographers start making photographs much larger than ever before. Larger than ever before, but it's not just a matter of size. They're making them larger than ever before because they want them to hang on the wall in a new sort of way. You could say that photography before this wasn't fundamentally made for the wall. You could take a photograph, you could take a great photograph by Ache or Gary Winogrand or Carjau, all sorts of photographers from the 19th and 20th century, and you could mat it and frame it and hang it on the wall, and you could then go and look at it. When you think about that, when you think of what you've done when you've looked at photographs like that, you'll realize that what you did was look into those photographs, as in a sense we're invited to look into these. But as photographs got larger and got to be made for the wall, they were fundamentally facing viewers looking at them, and a viewer looked at them more than into them. And this is something that's been of great interest to photographers. But then this also raises the issue of getting the scale of the photographs right. In this case, I think Tsujimoto's gotten the scale of these photographs beautifully. Subsequently, he's printed numbers of these photographs considerably larger. In my opinion, when these photographs get printed larger, when you take the same negative and print it larger, I think there's a loss. There's a loss of a certain sort of intensity. We don't have that to see here. But so I would, in this room, I would, you know, call your attention to these in particular. Now we're going to go on the way into the next room. We'll pause here. This is by the same artist, Ed Ruscha, who made the large painting with the clock face and the simple fishing rod back in the other room. And this is a part of a project which is now legendary. I was sort of aware of this at the time. I think this is sort of like 1966. What Ruscha did was make an artist's book of the simplest sort in which he reproduces photographs, simple photographs that he made of every single building on Sunset Strip in Los Angeles. This is, again, an example of a kind of conceptual project. It's an idea-based project. But this has come to see, if you were lucky enough to have acquired one of those books in 1966, you could decide what you wanted to do with the rest of your career right now. If you didn't want to work anymore, you probably wouldn't have to work anymore. I may be exaggerating slightly. In retrospect, it seems like a very brilliant move. Let me just say that one of the things that it demonstrates, and you can see how this fits into a show organized around ideas of time and space, because on the one hand you're getting this sequence of shots, but it also implies the movement up and down Sunset Strip in Los Angeles. But what you also see here is something that becomes very important in the photography of this whole period, and that's a certain documentary impulse. An impulse in photographers on the part of many of the photographers, to not want to do anything too personally expressive. I mean, you could say the dominant style of the most important photography of the generations before this was something called street photography. It was made possible by the invention of the small, portable 35-millimeter camera, classically the Swiss Leica, which was invented in the 1920s. And suddenly a photographer like Cartier-Bresson, or in America Gary Winogrand, could go out in the street with a little camera loaded with 35-millimeter film, walk around, see people walking around, and take pictures like that. People didn't even know they were being photographed. You were catching them instantaneously. You might be shooting at, you know, however many hundredths of a second. You could freeze action. And this was a very important dynamic movement in photography. By the 1960s and 70s, it had in itself started to run out of gas. I mean, that is to say, even someone like Winogrand came to feel there was nothing that you could do. It's as if one had seen everything that that style of photographing could yield, could produce. And it came to an end. It's something that might be opened up again now, after everything that's happened since. It's not as if this is necessarily something that came to an end forever. But one of the things that replaced it was this documentary impulse, where instead of trying to capture things on the fly and very, very rapidly, you would set yourself up in front of certain motifs in a very, very, almost like one-to-one deadpan way and make the photo and try to then figure out how to work with it. The greatest practitioners of this were a remarkable German couple named Bernd and Hilla Becher, who taught photography at the Kunstakademie in Düsseldorf through all of these years. One of the fantastic things about art in general is you just don't know in advance. Not only do you not know who's going to do what, but you don't know where they're going to do it. Where is the spirit of art going to settle down and start to produce remarkable work? I mean, the idea that in the immediate aftermath of World War II, if someone had said, well, where do you think the most important art academy is going to be, art school is going to be in the world for the next 30 years, the answer would not have been obvious that it was going to be Dusseldorf. But it turned out to be Dusseldorf. And all sorts of remarkable artists were there, but no one more remarkable than this couple, the Bechers, who then became very, very, very important teachers for a couple of generations of terrific younger German photographers. The Bechers themselves made thousands of remarkable photographs of different industrial structures, which again, they did in something like a completely documentary spirit, setting up a view camera, 8x10 or 4x5, directly in front of these structures and photographing them in as direct and unemphatic and impersonal a way as they could do. If we had a room full of the Bechers, I could happily talk about them for hours. I think they're completely remarkable. But you might say that what America had, in retrospect, is the closest thing to the equivalent of the Bechers, completely different in the scale of the project and the magnitude of the project, was Ruscha with something like this. It was the same impulse, of deadpan documentary. All right, now we move into a truly spectacular room. So all of these are photographs by Hiroshi Sugimoto, the photographer who made the movie theaters. And they are views. In a sense, they're not views. They are photographs of different seas and oceans in different places in the world. And again, what you have is, you see that Sugimoto is a photographer who likes to have a procedure, right? It's the opposite, let's say, of going out in the street with your 35mm camera and shooting stuff on the fly. Sugimoto, this is part of his heritage from a kind of conceptualism, likes to have a long-term project with a very, you could say in this case, even rigorous procedure. What's the procedure? The procedure is that he goes to one or another place in the world, all over the world, looking out at the sea. He finds a particular vantage point, and he sets up an 8x10 viewfinder camera. I mean, this is an extraordinarily cumbersome kind of object to manipulate. He has to shoot on a tripod. 8x10 is really large. It's got a viewing glass at the back of it. He would have to get under a kind of hood. He'd see an inverted image, and then he would make his photograph. He's established a protocol from the earliest of these. The earliest of these photographs is 1980. He does works from 1980 on into the 1990s. And in all cases, he puts the horizon line at exactly the same point in the photograph. So each photograph, you could say, is procedurally identical to all the others. But we get different bodies of water, different light conditions, different weather conditions, and so on. Tsujimoto talks about this as being some kind of return to the world before mankind, as if the impulse here is to set up a series of views that would evoke some kind of almost primordial reality, the world as it was first created. I was going to say curated. another way of thinking about it is that with a procedure like this, it's as if what he's doing is underlining, and this is also true of the movies, that this isn't about something that Tsujimoto went and saw and decided to photograph. He had a determination to make this, once he got the project going, to continue the project. It's what the camera, you could say, saw and recorded. It's what the camera recorded following these particular protocols in these different places. In that sense, that's what I meant when I corrected myself when we first came in here and I said they're views. I said, actually, they're not views. It's just, these are not meant to show you what you would see, what he saw, what someone would see if they were actually there. It's what a camera recorded at that spot under those conditions. They are, in all sorts of ways, obviously very beautiful photographs. And now here again we get into issues of scale. Originally, these photographs were printed much considerably smaller. They were sort of roughly the size of the movie theaters that you see in the other room. Tsujimoto, over his career, over the last 10 years, has in many cases printed much larger than he did before. Here he's upped the size of the printing. And then we get this extraordinarily effective exhibition mise-en-scène. These photographs were exhibited this way in a remarkable exhibition, a retrospective exhibition of work by Tsujimoto that was held at the Hirshhorn, I can't remember, maybe 5 years ago. And one came into this room, and this is what it looked like. How are they exhibited? They feel almost transparent, don't they? Your sense looking at them is almost as if they are black and white transparencies lit from behind. They're not. They're photographs, and they're being hit by spots that make them glow against the dark and give them that feeling of something like transparency. It's spectacularly effective. It's a wonderfully evocative room. I'm not sure whether this is the best way for Tsujimoto to present his photographs as photographs. Tsujimoto is brilliant at arranging a kind of mise-en-scène for his work. For me, it sometimes gets a little much, too much towards what I would call the theatrical. I'm happier, like anybody, I'm swept away by the feeling of this room. It's, in a certain sense, gorgeous. But then I want to grab hold of myself and resist the gorgeousness. What I wish is that in another room we had a few of these pictures at the smaller scale presented as photographs that you could walk up very close to and really pick up the fine detail. It's much harder here to pick up the fine detail of the water, the small waves, the wavelets, the currents, and so on and so forth. This is spectacularly effective, but it also produces a certain kind of generalized aura that, it, for me, a little bit works against the genius of these photos at their best. I'm just giving you that as a personal take on this, but this is one spectacular room, and Tsujimoto is a deeply interesting artist. Okay, let's move on. This is a great room to come back to when there aren't lots of people and just spend some contemplation time in it. So here we have, two artists in succession, quite brilliantly on this wall, right after you come in, are some small motion study photographs by the infinitely great 19th century American painter Thomas Eakins, who's born in the 1840s, lives to 1916. He's exactly the same generation, born within a year of Henry James. Eakins is a great, great, great painter, one of the great painters of the 19th century, one of the great American artists ever in any medium. There are magnificent paintings by him in the National Gallery of Art. which I recommend to you, including A Little Baby Called Baby at Play, which is a baby born from the planet Krypton. I mean, it's super baby, and it's a completely compelling picture. At a certain point, Aikens, along with others, there are figures in France, a man named Marais, became tremendously interested in trying to understand exactly what happens when people walk or run or jump and so on. What this initially rose in France as a question about whether when a horse runs, there's any moment where all its legs are off the ground at the same time. And people spent, you know, entire years not only riding horses but studying them closely. And it turned out no one could figure it out. It just happened too fast. But by working with photography, setting up a sequence where, as a horse ran, a whole lot of photographs were triggered, it emerged that, yes, they could work out exactly how the gait of the horse worked. And it turned out to be significantly different from what the most important equestrian painters of the period came up with. It was absolutely devastating to a very important painter named Meissonier, who had spent his entire life depicting horses running incorrectly, as it turned out. I mean, I'm not saying this to pick fun on Meissonier. You can imagine what it would be to sort of stake your life as an artist on something and then have technology come and show you up. It must have been traumatic. And what we have here are a whole lot of these, in a way, exceptionally, these were not made as art. Right? These were made as something like scientific studies. But they are fantastically beautiful, and they are absolutely worth studying closely. We won't do that tonight. But it was a brilliant inclusion of these in this exhibition. Now, we come to another work. There is a Scottish artist born in Glasgow named Douglas Gordon. Douglas Gordon is in his mid-40s, just about 45 years old now. And what we're seeing is a work of his called Play Dead, / Real Time, from 2003. You've got a big screen here, and these screens are translucent. So as you'll see, if you go around to the other side, you see the image from the other side. And there's a second screen there, and there's a TV monitor in the corner. Okay? And this is an elephant named Minnie. And she's walking around an interior space, which actually turns out to be the interior space of the Gagosian Gallery in New York. And there's a camera that's on some kind of dolly. And as you can see, the camera here is circling this elephant in a clockwise direction as the elephant does what it does. And then on the other screen, the primary side depicts the camera on the dolly circling the elephant in a counterclockwise direction. The two screens are set up roughly at right angles to one another, plus the little monitor down there. Now, this for me is a work that has a lot of significance because I came across it by chance when it was exhibited at the Gagosian Gallery in 2003. I was going through Chelsea in New York, which I do every month, just doing galleries. And I walked up, and someone had said to me in the street before I went upstairs, look, you're about to go up, and you're going to see a big video installation with two screens, and there's going to be an elephant. And the elephant is going to walk around a little bit, and then the elephant's going to lie down, and it's going to play dead the way it's doing it right now, and then eventually the elephant's going to get up, and it's going to walk around some more, and the screen will go black, and then it's going to do that again, and it's going to do it again, and that's going to be... And you're going to think it's just stunning. You're going to think it's a masterpiece. I would have bet anything. Right? I would have bet, I don't even want to think what, whatever I had, that there was no chance in the world that I was going to be blown away by a video of an elephant getting up and lying down. Now, the trouble with what I'm doing right now is I'm talking much too much. I mean, what you need to do is spend time with this. I think this is one of the major works of the last 10 years. I think Douglas Gordon is a remarkable artist, an artist of tremendous originality. I have since then gotten to know Gordon very well. We're friends. I've written much more about him. And let's just look at this for a second while we stand here. You'll notice that basically the image is almost always severely cropped. We're made aware of where the image comes to an end. Absolutely sure those aren't two guys wearing an elephant costume? See what I mean? You almost can't help the thought. Now it moves backwards. It's clearly receiving instructions from a trainer who's in the room also. In fact, on the dolly, there's a photographer's assistant who's helping with the lens, and the trainer. Douglas Gordon is himself is outside the space, seeing the image on a monitor, able to communicate with the people making the photograph. There's something powerfully sculptural about the image. But I suppose what I wanted, what I'd want to ask you, if we were going to spend enough time here, is really the very simple question of, what does this make you feel? Goes black for a while, and now the elephant's on the ground, and it's going to play dead. It's clearly been told to do so. Now it's been told to get up. Okay, so for me, part of the—I mean, again, this is a work that you have to activate for yourself. You come in, you spend time with this image. You can see it from the other side. You go to the other screen. You look at the monitor, which has another way of organizing the same basic. Imagery, and what I want to suggest is that it really leads one. I mean, I become terribly aware of my inability not to project certain feelings into and about the elephant, right? As if I am. I can't help but anthropomorphize the elephant to some extent. I can't help but feel my own way into its bodily being as different as it is from my bodily being. There's enough. There's a bodily sac. There are these legs. There's then even the sense of what it's doing. Is it a little bit being abused? I mean, by what right does Douglas film this elephant walking around and lying down and getting up? Sometimes the effort that it seems to make in getting up. I think the work is, one of the functions of this work, one of the intents of this work, is to make us aware of our tendency to project empathically into this animal. This is to say that it's as if it picks up on something that works of art have made us do forever, which is empathically project. But works of art tend to do this in such a way that we don't realize we're doing it. It's as if we tend to think the feeling is in Caravaggio's Magdalene. She's sitting there. She is consumed with grief. She is consumed with shame. The feelings are in her. But all she's doing is sitting there. The feelings have been put there, in a sense, by us, by various triggers in the painting. But in something like this work, this tendency towards something like empathic projection, because we're dealing with an animal, because we're dealing with this temporal medium, it's as if we can, it makes us almost catch ourselves in the act of doing this empathic projection. This, to me, is part of the great interest of this work. Anyway, I find this an extremely powerful and convincing work. What does one call it? A work of something like video. We don't have any kind of adequate vocabulary at this point for discussing works like these. But I'm totally, as a critic, I'm totally persuaded by Play Dead Real Time, as well as by many other works by Gordon. Certainly, any chance that you ever get to see any work by Gordon, take it. Okay, here we're in a room of photographs, and all the photographs are by the same photographer, a youngish German photographer who basically makes his career in London, named Wolfgang Tillmans. Right? And it's a very characteristic display of photographs by Tillmans. He's a very, very successful and admired younger photographer. I fundamentally don't like his work. Tillmans is, again, he's a very intelligent photographer, but he's sort of committed to an aesthetic where the idea is don't try to make a magnificent or a beautiful photograph. The nature of photography is to be a kind of incidental, everyday medium. There's no reason why we should value a photograph of one sort over a photograph of another. Let's get away from any idea of a hierarchy of subject matter. Why shouldn't a photograph of a little bit of dirt on the floor be just as good as a photograph of a magnificent scene or whatever? You can see that, I mean, there's a certain logic to the position, but what it produces, and then also in displaying the photographs, he very much wants to get away from any kind of ordinary fine arts mode of display. So we get a kind of casual, invented for every occasion, spotting of photographs on the wall. So we get that small photograph up there, another small photograph over there. He did, one exhibition that he did had the title, If One Thing Matters, Everything Matters. And I suppose, I mean, it's not worthy to really put it this way, but I think that's just wrong. I think in order for something to matter, it has to really matter. So this is a position in photography. Those are all photographs, everything on that wall, are photographs that he made of the Concorde when it was still flying. Right? But it's not as if we're being offered those as a series of terrific photographs. They are there as almost like specimen photographs held together by the single content of the Concorde. He's a very competent photographer. He's an interesting photographer. But it feels to me ultimately is a certain kind of aesthetic mistake. Right? I'm just giving you, okay, believe me, he doesn't need my liking him. His life is terrific without it. So. This is a movie by a Japanese movie maker named Takehiko Imura called Ma, which is a sound, Space, Time, and the Garden of Rion-ji from 1989. That's one of the spectacularly beautiful Zen gardens is it Nara or Kyoto? Kyoto. Again, I mean, this is something for you to come and see and spend some time with. I don't want to say anything prematurely. For me, there's some kind of contradiction in terms in this movie. I mean, I've been to that garden. You want to see it at a certain sort of distance. These different stone elements, rock elements that are in it are spaced in significant ways. You never have the experience of moving in for this kind of close-up. It's just not at all clear what we're being offered by way of an experience of this garden and even of its Zen character by a movie that gives us close-ups, that tracks it, that gives us that sound on the soundtrack. You need the totality. I think you need the totality. So for me, there are moments, we haven't hit it here, but there's a certain amount of text that tells us what we should be feeling, and I get very irritated with that. It feels really un-Zen. Okay, but I mean, as Clement Greenberg once said to Princess Margaret, don't take my word for it. And Princess Margaret said, oh, Mr. Greenberg, I would never dream of doing that. So, well, there. Okay. And here's another Ankawara painting. They're spotted through the exhibition, I think, very brilliantly. Okay, here we have two paintings. one on canvas on the right, the other sort of in tempera on paper on the left, by a wonderful American painter from the American West named Mark Tobey, born in 1890, very much a member of the sort of first great generation of American abstract paintings, both in a style that came to be known as something like white writing, as if you got a almost Eastern calligraphy. They're meant to be very contemplative objects. Tobey is a wonderful painter. Again, not made for a situation like this. These are paintings where you want to come in, have time with them yourself, lose yourself in front of them. That's what they're meant to operate that way. They're deeply, you could say, meditative works, works of genuine high seriousness. Let's now. There's no simple way. We can't go into this exactly. But so let me just say, what we're in this space where the music's coming out of is an extremely interesting movie made by an artist, an exact contemporary, really, of Douglas Gordon's, a British woman named Tacita Dean, who, like Gordon, lives in Berlin now. Tacita Dean works in photography, but above all, she works in film, and she continues to use old-fashioned film techniques. In fact, so old-fashioned that it's become hard for her to get her film developed and so on. She likes to shoot in 16-millimeter film and so on. She's an artist of exceptional intelligence and refinement. This particular work is shot at the very top of a large radio TV tower. It's called Fernsehturm, which Fernseh is the German for television, in Berlin. And at the top of this tower is a restaurant that rotates very, 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 very slowly. And she's set up a movie camera in there shooting through the day as this restaurant slowly rotates and we see the sun go down and so on and so forth. Earlier, there was, if you came at an earlier phase in this movie, there wouldn't be this music. At a certain point, you could say in the late afternoon or evening, the band starts to play and so on. Again, it's a work that you've got to go in, sit there, and give yourself up to. You've got to watch it for I think it's a 40-minute film. You've got to give it that time. One of the things she's trying to do, as she says, is to actually make the passage of time palpable, feelable. Again, that would be part of how that fits into the project of this series of works. Excuse me?
I think it says drenched.
Okay, drenched in time. Okay, that makes perfect sense. It's quite beautiful. And so, again, we can't all go in there and do some time with it now. But Dean is another extremely interesting artist of this moment, completely serious person, and again, making works that you're supposed to look at and give yourself up to and feel your way into. By this time, it's deep night. By the way, you can start, I think by now you really get a sense of how brilliantly arranged this exhibition is, simply as an exhibition. As you move from one space to another, from a lighter space to a darker space. And what you're looking at now, the main work on that wall, is a photograph by the photographer Jeff Wall, W-A-L-L. Wall is in his 60s. He looks about 18. He lives in Vancouver, in Canada. Wall started making photographs like this around 1977. He is today one of the absolutely most best-known and most admired art photographers at work anywhere in the world. He's also an exceptionally brilliant person and has written by far the most interesting texts about art photography of the last 30 years, but also on other things as well. I mean, Wall is a completely remarkable guy. From the start, what he wanted to do, the medium that he chose, and this is a perfect example of the kind of works that enlarge the scale of the photograph, and where you can sense how much this photograph was conceived right from the start as being made for the wall, something that we face. So our relation to it is a face-to-face relationship. This is something new in the history of photography. The other innovation that Wall did was to make his photographs as large color transparencies and mount them on light boxes so that behind the transparency, there's fluorescent bulbs behind here with a kind of metal frame. And the whole thing lit from behind, so we get this extraordinary sense of light. Now, in fact, Wall has stopped doing it. He's not working this way anymore. He discovered that the color transparencies were not ultimately stable enough in the long run. And part of Wall's ambition as an artist, Wall wants his works to be around in 500 years so that people can check them out and see if they're still as good as they look when he first made them. Okay? In other words, he's a deeply, seriously, deeply ambitious artist. And the technology now allows him to print those photographs opaquely, no longer as transparencies, in a way that will be more coloristically durable in the long run. So that, for example, he has told any museum that has one of the earlier works that he will replace that work with an opaque work sort of at cost. I mean, the museum pays simply for, let's say, what it cost him to print the new work, but he will replace it. He's also been making photographs, large black and white photographs that are opaque, that are simply beautiful. Wall is a tremendously interesting artist, and right from the start, he found himself working in the following way. This is a scene outside of Ankara, Turkey. Wall had been traveling, he saw the place, and there's a story here. The story here is that this is a young guy from a village arriving in the outskirts of Ankara, like to pick up whatever kind of life he can pick up there. Wall, this is not a candid photograph. In other words, Wall was not there with some kind of large Leica. And one day he saw this kid arrive carrying his little bag, and Wall kind of click, gotcha, and then set up the photograph. On the contrary, he went there, he saw something that he wanted to do. He found the place. He then figured out what he wanted the subject to be. And he would have gone back there. He might have spent 10 days there, 2 weeks there. He would have found someone to do the part of this young man. Maybe he saw a young man and persuaded him to do it again. He might have auditioned, in effect, 20, 30 young men before he found the one he wanted. He would then have made a series of photographs. He would have used a viewfinder camera, a view camera. There would have been a camera on a tripod, maybe a 4x5-inch camera rather than an 8x10-inch camera, but still on a tripod. And he would have made a lot of shots in order to get... Now, you'll notice as you look at this, you'll see how much of this is in sharp focus through a lot of the distance, how much it's in sharp focus across this whole expanse. It would be very hard to get a single shot out of a camera that would give you that kind of clarity and that kind of evenness across that total expanse when blown up to something like this size. So he would have taken a whole lot of shots, very precisely registered in relation to one another. And then back in Vancouver, over a period of time, with the help of assistants, he would have sutured the shots he wanted together with the aid of a computer. So there's no time, and I don't know the answer. There is an answer to how many shots eventually got sutured together to make this particular, at different focal lengths and so on and so forth, to make the photograph that we're seeing right now. But that's the procedure. It's an extremely labor-intensive procedure, producing a work, again, that isn't exactly what anyone could have seen had they been at that spot. And in fact, it's not even what any single camera, you could say, could have seen at that spot. There's an entire synthetic, again, series of protocols, more complex than Tsujimoto's, in order to end up with a photograph that is going to be what Wall wants it to be. And there are certain motifs that come up again and again in Wall. For example, this kind of setting, the wires overhead, and so on. Wall is a photographer, I want to say, of enormous achievement and very considerable brilliance. And any chance you get to look at work by him is like totally worth doing. For me, getting involved with his work, coming to see his work and get a feeling for it, and then getting to know him was for me a very important stage in my own involvement with art photography, my own ability to begin to feel I had that something truly fascinating was going on. Let's move on. So this is a work by a Belgian photographer. Belgian photographer and film artist. Hard to put a single word on what he is named. David Clairbout, or Clairbout. C-L-A-E-R-B-O-U-T. I'm not even sure of how to pronounce it. He's quite well known. He's had a number of significant shows, mainly in Europe. He's an extremely interesting figure. And again, what we're seeing with Douglas Gordon, with Tacita Dean, with Wall, and now with Clairbout, is the whole area of photography and the interface between photography and film and video has become a very, very fruitful area for artists really all over right now. In this case, Clairbout has taken a scene, a single shot, a single event in China, which is a family, it's black and white, a family all gathered around a very simple event of a ball being thrown in the air and from one kid to another and with parents and others looking up at it. I'll let some of this just play out so you get a sense of how this works. Every single shot that we're seeing depicts exactly the same instant, you might say, but from a succession of very disparate points of view. And as you become aware of that, you become aware that he must have had cameras set up all over, shooting from 25, 30, 40, 50, as it were, points of view. You never spot any of the cameras, though. So the effect is of something like the multiple revelation of aspects of the scene, for he thinks of it as multiple revelation of aspects of a single moment in time, as if the moment in time were some kind of physical unit that could almost be sliced and viewed from different angles at different distances. And as with Tsujimoto, you can see that it's as if it's a very important part. Again, there's a procedure. There's a procedure for making this work. And we're very much being offered it as if it is not something that anyone could have seen had they been there. This is something that unites a whole lot of artists of various sorts at this moment, trying to make works which are on the one hand intensely visual, intensely presented to us as to be seen by us, but where we're not being invited to imagine a point of view from which that scene could have been seen in the first place, could have been viewed in the first place, and which the camera then records. The apparatus is there to make available to us, to present to our vision, something that could not have been seen. Can any of you think how this work might be better? Any suggestions? Can't hear. No music, yes. Yeah, the music is deliberately kind of random Muzak music. So you might say that the artist has outsmarted one. That is to say, he's chosen music whose, as it were, kitschiness is absolutely explicit. But the trouble with that kind of move is you just never know when you reach a point of safety. I mean, that he knows it's kitschy, that he means it to be kitschy, doesn't in the end prevent it from being kitschy. I find this a fascinating work, and I would like to come back with earplugs. Or I would like to be hearing Bach or Webern or something, but not this. But this gives you a good sense of what the scene is. Okay. Well, if you find it moving, that's okay. We won't spend a long time in here. The work on this wall is by an artist named Hamish Fulton. The work here is by a British artist named Richard Long. who, starting in the late 60s as a very young artist, trained at St. Martin's, where Anthony Caro taught, started making works of art really based on the idea of long walks that he took in the British countryside and then elsewhere. And then he also gathers things like rocks and makes them into little circles like this. And to put it really simply, I find this extremely conventional and uninteresting and tame. And I'm not going to spend any more time on it. And then the last work in the show for us, it's a work by a German artist named Wolfgang Staehle, S-T-A-E-H-L-E. I didn't really know about his work, but what he does is basically set up a camera and stream shots, you know, without moving the camera, without inflecting it in any way. So again, so many of the works that we're looking at tonight, you might say, defy the kind of talk that I'm giving, because you really have to spend time in front of them. You've got to, this is Niagara, it's really about, in some sense, just presenting the endlessness of this incredible quantity of heavy water falling dramatically off and pounding down. In order to get something out of this work, it doesn't do at all to stand here as we're doing now and give it a minute or two. One really has to be here by oneself or with some friend and stand there for 10 minutes or 15 minutes and see whether some kind of powerful experience gets generated by that. I mean, I find this interesting, but not in a class with the works that, let's say, I admired most of all tonight, some of the Sugimoto, the Tacita Dean, the Douglas Gordon, the Jeff Wall, needless to say, the Aikenses, the Tobys, and so on. Okay, you've actually been doing this for more than an hour, and I thank you for your attention. Thank you. Thanks a lot.